All right, good morning, everybody. Next week, I will be here, but I will not be here. My good friend Les Horning, the Reverend Les, will be sharing with us next week, and I hope you're able to be here. Les is a sharp guy. He's got a bachelor's degree and master's degree in chemistry. He worked for a number of years as a chemist, and then he felt a call to ministry, went through seminary, and then later did PhD studies in Old Testament. So he's a real sharp guy, a very interesting fellow, and he will be sharing with us. He is now working for Eastern Mennonite University. So again, if you're around on the weekend following Thanksgiving, I hope that you can be here. Unfortunately, many of us, probably none of us, will be around in a little more than a month, because as you all know, the end of the world is coming. This is 2012. You're aware of this, right? You know the calendar year. And the Mayan calendar tells us that in just over a month, I believe it's December 21st, the world will be coming to an end. So there were three friends sitting around having a conversation one day, asking the question, what would you do if you knew that you only had 4 more weeks on this earth? And one friend said, well, I would go out to my friends, my neighbors, and my relatives, and I would preach the gospel. I would teach them about Jesus' love for them and try to make sure that they were living and that they were able to get right with God. The friends agreed that was a pretty good way to spend your last 4 weeks. And the second friend said, well, I would empty my savings account, I would liquidate my 401k and all of my assets, and I would go and see the world. I would travel near and far and take it all in while this earth is still here. And his friend thought, well, again, that's really not a bad idea. And the third friend said, if I knew I only had 4 weeks left on this earth, I would spend those 4 weeks at my mother-in-law's house. And the other friends were obviously taken aback by this. They were a little bit confused. So they asked him, why would you spend your last 4 weeks on this earth at your mother-in-law's house? And he said, because I know they would be the longest 4 weeks of my life. And my wife gets to spend some time with her mother-in-law this week. And we all love my mom. We all love our mother-in-laws. This is not the point of today's message. But today we are talking about the end of something. The end, perhaps, of the world. That's the way this scripture is normally interpreted. But I think I'm going to take probably a new way, a new approach to looking at this passage. Something that maybe you haven't heard before, maybe you haven't been exposed to before. So hopefully it doesn't sound too heretical and too far out there for you if this is the way you've always interpreted Mark chapter 13. There's many different ways to go about understanding this passage. And the reason that it is so commonly debated is because this passage is weird. If you're taking notes, you can write that one down. This is a very technical word. You learn this with this theological training that comes as a part of seminary training. This is a weird passage. And I say it's weird because if you read through this text, especially the verses following the ones that Ryan read for us, you hear all sorts of strange things. You hear about how the sun becomes dark. And you hear about how the stars fall from the sky. And you hear about the abomination of desolation or something like that. And I feel like when I have to say that, I have to say it really jowly in like a 1950s preacher. The abomination that is the desolation, you know. It's put the fear of God in you. What a strange passage. Now the reason it's strange is because this is what we call apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature uses a specific kind of language. It uses apocalyptic language. And apocalyptic language is the kind of language that we read in apocalyptic books like the book of Daniel and Revelation. And the reason it's strange is because it's very symbolic. If you read any of those books, Daniel, Revelation, or Mark chapter 13 and its parallels, you see these strange symbols, these strange signs. There's this use of numbers and things like stars falling from the sky and the sun turning to darkness and then rivers flowing in blood. It's just odd. So that is why it is so hard to know just what this passage is about. And that's why I'm going to present to you perhaps a different understanding of Mark chapter 13 today. Now, before we get into the text, I think we need to come to a better understanding of the word apocalypse. Anybody here watch sci-fi movies or read science fiction books? Very few of you, all right. Twilight is maybe a little sci-fi. Apocalyptic language is probably something that we hear in these science fiction books, and we hear it from the doom and gloom pastors, the guys that do get very jowly and talk about the abomination of the desolation. This is very common language, but apocalypse does not necessarily mean the end of the world. The word apocalypse comes from the Greek construct apokalupsis. Apokalupsis. Anybody want to try that? No. Apokalupsis literally means to uncover or to reveal. And it's also commonly translated as revelation. When we think of revelation, we automatically probably go to the book of Revelation, but it literally just means to reveal something, to take something that was unknown and make it known. Like, I had cereal for breakfast this morning. You didn't know that. You just experienced an apokalupsis. Probably not worth writing down and putting in the Bible, though. But this is what the word literally means. When we talk about this being apocalyptic literature, it is revealing something that previously had not been known. And today's chapter from Mark 13 is called sometimes the Little Apocalypse. Is this one chapter in the Bible seemingly odd and standing out from the rest of Mark's gospel, this little revealing, this little revelation. So we come to this passage in Mark 13, and we need to remember everything that was leading up to this point. Last week we looked at the widow's mite, and we talked about how to understand the widow's mite and the giving of that money, we have to first go back and read the chapters in the Bible leading up to that point. So we went all the way back to Mark chapter 11, and Mark chapter 11 is Jesus entering into the city of Jerusalem on the back of a donkey, an event that we call the triumphal entry. The next day after Jesus goes into Jerusalem, he goes to the temple and he cleanses it. He chases out the money exchangers and the animal sellers. These people are corrupting the temple. He says, "You are making my father's house into a den of thieves." And from that point on, Jesus has this give and take with the leaders of the synagogue, of the temple. He's calling them out for the way they're abusing the system, the way they are milking people for all of their money, trying to get every last dime they can out of these people. And that widow's mite, that giving there, remember, that is in response to Jesus critiquing the leaders of the temple for devouring widows' houses. So we come to today's passage, and Jesus and his disciples, they are just witnessing this widow giving her mite. And they walk out the door, and we find this in verse 1. As Jesus was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." Now, wasn't this disciple a Jew? Didn't he see this all the time? Well, no, because this was something new to him. The temple was being renovated. King Herod at the time, this King Herod guy, he was a real piece of work, I tell you what. He had some real self-confidence issues. King Herod taxed the people heavily, and then he went around all of his kingdom and he built magnificent buildings. He built extravagant palaces and he built extravagant, magnificent temples, plural, not just temples to the Hebrew God, but temples to other gods too, just in case. He spent a lot of money, a lot of the people's money, building extravagant things so that his legacy would last throughout all of eternity. People still refer to this temple as Herod's temple. So Herod had begun this renovation process, and it lasted over 40 years, which should make my wife feel a little bit more comfortable with the renovation projects in our house. This only lasted about 18 months at this point. 40-some years Herod was doing these renovation projects on the temple, and he built it magnificently. Massive stones, magnificent buildings, pillars huge, hewn out of marble. It was truly impressive. So this is what the disciple is calling attention to. But Jesus comes back with this response. He says, "Do you see all these great buildings? Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." Have you ever met somebody who just rains on your parade? You're really excited about something and they just come in and throw water upon it. That's kind of what Jesus is doing. Yeah, as great as this thing is, as wonderful as this temple looks, it's not going to last forever. There will come a time when all of these stones are torn down. There will be a time when all of these buildings are destroyed. And you know what? Jesus was right. The year 70 AD, the Roman Empire marched through Jerusalem and flattened Herod's temple. Now, I didn't mention that Herod's renovations were completed in the year 64 AD. So that means 6 years later, everything was wiped out. You see, there was a revolt that took place. The Jews rose up against the Roman Empire. And this is one of the ways that the Romans tried to squelch any kind of uprising. They would not only wipe out people and town, but they would wipe out their holy places. So that they not only broke the backs of the people, they broke their spirits as well. So Jesus seems to be saying here that this temple will be destroyed. Now, many people will talk about this as being a prediction of the end times. This is popular theology. Theology that's made popular. I won't name the authors because I'm not going to say good things about them. But some of these authors that write books about the end of the world, the apocalypse, they sometimes call it. And these books, if you want to read them, that's all fine. But just remember that they are fiction books. They aren't necessarily depicting something as it will happen. And I believe that when Jesus is talking to his disciples about things, he's not talking about the end of the world. He's talking about the end of the world as the disciples know it. He's talking about the end of the temple system. You see, I don't know why people, well, maybe I can see why they might interpret it as this being the end of the world. But I think it makes much more sense to just simply say this is about the end of the temple. Remember the whole process here. Jesus has rode into town on the donkey. He's been critiquing the temple system, calling out the leaders of the temple for the way that they are misleading and abusing the power that they've had. And then the disciples point out the beauty of the temple. And Jesus says, well, it's all going to fall down one day. It's all going to be destroyed. And then they ask the most natural question that would come after that. What would you ask next? When? Exactly. When's this going to happen? And Jesus then goes into this apocalyptic language, this weird kind of language about these signs and symbols, these things that are yet to come. And he says, when you see these things, the things that we're talking about, the destruction of the temple will occur. I think when people interpret this as being a way of referring to the end times, we're making Jesus into being this very ADD individual. This person that just can't stay on track. His mind is all over the place. But it seems pretty obvious to me that what he's talking about is the destruction of the temple. Now the next question that people will ask is, did those things happen? Those things that Jesus predicted, the things that Jesus said would occur when the temple would be destroyed. Did those things happen at or around the year 70 AD? And the first sign that Jesus mentions is that there will be false messiahs. Now, before the temple was destroyed, there was a person who rose up and was believed to be the Messiah. And this individual gathered a large number of people. He had a large following. About 4,000 people were following after him. And he led them out into the wilderness, into the desert, where they were going to start this new community, a monastic community, where they would, you know, stay away from all those Roman individuals, and they were going to start their own worshiping group. And those 4,000 people died in the desert. Sounds to me like this false Messiah led the people astray. There was another Messiah, a would-be Messiah, a false Messiah, that rallied the people together and encouraged them to rise up against the Roman Empire. And it was because of this false Messiah that Rome came and leveled the temple. It sounded like that false Messiah, again, led the people astray. All right, the next sign that Jesus lifts out is in verse 7. He talks about wars and rumors of war. Have there been wars and rumors of war since that day? Yeah, I think so. Has there been time when there hasn't been wars and rumors of wars? Probably not. I mean, right now we're talking about, we talk in the news about this war going on in Israel. And I'm sure, I haven't heard it yet, but I'm sure that people are talking about how this might be the end of the world because there is this war going on right now. I don't think that's what Jesus is talking about. And it's clear that there were wars and rumors of wars taking place in the year 70 AD. Earthquakes, famines, all the time. There was an earthquake the day that Jesus was crucified. There have been famines nonstop since then. And what about persecution? That's not in our text from today. But after the section that Ryan led to us, they begin talking about these persecutions that will come. This will be a sign that the things that Jesus spoke of are going to happen. Were there persecutions in Jesus' day, in the disciples' age, the years up to 70 AD? Absolutely. More so than what we've ever seen in our lifetime. In the year 64 AD, the Roman Caesar Nero outlawed Christianity. And if you were found to be a Christian, you know what was what happened to you? You were killed. Nero used to take Christians, impale them, and use them as a torch to light his garden. That is persecution. So these things that Jesus said will happen before the destruction of the temple, they happened before the year of 70 AD. So I think, again, Jesus isn't talking about the end of the world. He's talking of the end of the world as they know it. The destruction of the temple. You see, the temple was the center of their life. For a practicing Jew, this was the center of their faith, the center of their worshiping community. And they would have taken their children when they were just born to the temple to dedicate them to God. Multiple times throughout the year, a practicing Jew would make the trip to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices in the temple. This was also the place where the major day on the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, every year all the Jewish men would go to Jerusalem to offer a sacrifice to be forgiven of their sins. This was the center of the world as they knew it, and it was coming to an end. Now, I want to spend the last bit of our time here this morning looking at the end of verse 8. Verse 8 says, this is again one of the signs that Jesus is talking about. He says, these are the beginnings of birth pains. There are some mothers here today who know what it's like to give birth to a human being. I, myself, I've never experienced that. I've never had a person growing within me, and I've never had the experience, let's say, of pushing a 7-pound human being out of my body. I've never done that, and actually, just as a side note, my wife's friend in Nebraska just gave birth to a 10-pound, 2-ounce baby this weekend. 10-pound, 4-ounce baby. I have no idea what that's like. I can't even imagine. But I was there when my children were born. So I at least saw some of the pain involved in giving birth to a child. Now, for whatever reason, my wife decided that she did not want to use any kind of pain modification in the birthing process. She did not accept an epidural or narcotics. She did not even use Tylenol. She wanted to do this naturally. So I witnessed firsthand the kind of pain that she went through, the kind of pushing and excruciating, I don't know any other way to say it. It hurt a lot, I could tell. I saw that, but I also saw when that little purplish, pink, slimy critter did come out and was placed upon her chest. I saw that all of that pain, it seemed to be worth it. In that moment, maybe you don't forget about the pain, but you realize that it is worth it. If it wasn't worth it, she wouldn't have done it again. Jesus talks about what they're about to go through as birth pains. And again, with the temple being the center of all of the religious activities, it surely would have been painful for them to see that system come to an end. But Jesus says something great is going to come out of it. Something worth it will replace the old system. Now, I want to quote a theologian by the name of Marcus Borg this morning. That was pretty cool, wasn't it? You want to see that again? I want to quote Marcus Borg this morning. Pow! Marcus Borg says this about the temple system. He says, according to the temple theology, certain kinds of sins and impurities could be dealt with only through sacrifice in the temple. Temple theology thus claimed an institutional monopoly on the forgiveness of sins. And because the forgiveness of sins was a prerequisite for entry into the presence of God, temple theology also claimed an institutional monopoly on access to God. You want access to God? You have to go through the temple system. You want to go through the temple system? You have to go through the high priest. Now let's do a little bit of a historical lesson here and talk a bit about the temple. This is an artistic rendition of Herod's temple. And we know from the books and some of the remaining remnants of Herod's temple, it's kind of what it looked like and how it was laid out. And we know that in Herod's temple, this is the outside walls that go around here, in Herod's temple there were several courtyards. And certain people were only allowed to go certain places within the courtyards and within the temple. Over here we see in this big open area that this was the Gentile courtyard. If you were a Gentile, that is anybody born from a different faith background other than the Hebrew background, even if you were converted, if you had gone through the conversion process, if you were a Gentile by birth, this is as far as you could come into the temple. Now, there's also a certain courtyard that is special for the women. If you were a Jewish woman born into a Jewish family, but again, a woman, you were only allowed to come so far. And this number 9 right here, this area here is designated as the women's courtyard. Now, if you were a Jewish man, but you weren't a priest, so you were born to any of the line, any of the family lineages up, other than the one of Levite, you could enter into up to about number 3 right here. Actually, you couldn't go that far. Sorry, number 4 over here, the Israelites' courtyard. The area right in front of the main source of the temple, which is called the Holy Place, that was reserved for the Levites. If you were a priest, you could come to that point. And if you were a certain kind of priest, the high priest, the most decorated, the most high up the hierarchy of the priests, you could enter into the high place. And if you were the high priest selected for a certain duty, one day a year, you could go to a certain part of the holy place. And that holy place is divided with this large curtain. And behind the curtain, only the one high priest selected each year could enter one day out of the year into the holy of holies, or the most holy place. And the most holy place had within it a number of relics. It had some candelabra, it had a menorah, it had the Ark of the Covenant, and it had within it, it said, the very presence of God. The Holy of Holies is where the Jewish people believed God resided. And that's why only one person, the high priest, on one day of the year is able to enter into the Holy of Holies and offer sacrifices on the Day of Atonement. Everybody else could only come so close. Now, I like the way that a man by the name of Peter Rollins talks about the Holy of Holies. And remember, the Holy of Holies is divided from the rest of the building by a thick curtain. And Peter Rollins uses the example of the story from The Wizard of Oz. You've seen that movie? You've heard the story, The Wizard of Oz? Kids, no? Yeah, okay. Wizard of Oz. We have the story of Dorothy and her young dog, Toto. And Dorothy is from Kansas, and one day she is swept up in a tornado, and her entire home is relocated to the land of Oz. And Dorothy is trying to get back to her home in Kansas, so she and Toto set out to find the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. Because, Sorry. They set out to find the wizard. And along their way, they find these very impoverished individuals. They find a lion, and this lion has no courage. They find a scarecrow, and the scarecrow has no brain. They find a tin man, the tin man has no heart. So these individuals, they gather together and they follow the yellow brick road to find the wizard. Because the wizard is believed to be able to offer them the things that they need. To offer them a heart, a mind, courage, and a way back to Kansas. Because who wouldn't want to go back to Kansas? When they finally arrive at the wizard's house, they enter into his courts. And there is a curtain there. And they tear back the curtain, and the wizard isn't there. On a Friday afternoon in the year 29 AD, Jesus was put to death. And it is said that at the time when Jesus let out his last breath, that curtain in the Holy of Holies split in two. And like those individuals, like Dorothy and her friends, when they tore back that curtain to find that the wizard was not in there, they found when that curtain tore in two that God was no longer in the Holy of Holies. No, God was now out among the people. God was now with those Gentiles in that far off court. God was now with the women in this area. They were now with the Gentiles, with the women, with the priests, with the regular individuals. They were not only with these people, they were with the lepers who were begging at the city gates. They were with the prostitutes that were trying to make ends meet. They were with the widows and the orphans. God was no longer in the Holy of Holies, only accessed by certain individuals on a particular day of the year. When that curtain tore in two, God became accessible to everyone through Jesus Christ. I like the way that N.T. Wright says it. He says, Jesus was inaugurating a way of life which had no further need for the temple. Some people will tell us that this passage from Mark 13 is about the end of the world that is yet to come. And I think that's fine if some people want to interpret that way. There's been many people, very intelligent people, that have interpreted this passage in such a way. But I believe that Jesus is talking about something different. I believe he's not talking about the end of the world, but the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine. Drop a little REM quote on you. And for both the people that get that, that's great. That's a song from the 1980s. I think that Jesus is telling us it's the end of the sacrificial system, the end of the temple system. And he's telling us that no longer do we have to go through a certain individual, a priest or a Levite, to come to God. But now through him, through his life, death, and resurrection, we all, regardless of our race, our gender, our IQ level, or our lineage, can come to the Father and talk to him directly. So let's do that right now. God, we thank you that you did for a time put in place a system that we call the temple system. But God, we thank you so much more that today we do not have to approach you through a priest or through another person, but that you have given us direct access to you through your Son. God, we thank you so much for that because we have been freed through this gift that you've given to us, free to come to you and to lead others to you as well. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.